From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, everyone. I'm Ira Melman.
Hello, Ira. I'm Jim Stevenson. Hi, on Jim. Today's program, better weather is accelerating the search for the major parts of a crashed Air Asia jetliner.
Francis Alonso talks about efforts to decrease the birth rate in one Asian nation.
On China Focus, Michael Lippin continues his report on the difficult time China is having getting its products recognized in the West.
In the American Cafe, a look at how one suburban area in the United States is trying to curb pedestrian death.
And in his Now segment, David Byrd tells us about a new way to treat diabetes.
We check business. We check sports as well. All of this on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America.
This is Daybreak Asia. Glad you could join us for a summary of Asian news and events for Tuesday, January 6th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, as the search and recovery for victims and debris from the December 28th crash of AirAsia Flight 8501 continues, Indonesia's meteorological agency said bad weather was the triggering factor behind the accident of the Airbus A320. The twin-engine jetliner fell into the Java Sea on a flight from Surabaya, Indonesia, to Singapore, killing all 162 on board. The agency said, based on an analysis of existing meteorological data, the most probable weather phenomenon was icing, which can cause engine damage. But Jeffrey Thomas, editor of the Australian air safety website AirlineRatings.com, told VOA's Victor Beattie he believes a more likely cause of the crash was a sharp downdraft in thunderstorms that the flight crew was trying to avoid.
Aircraft regularly fly in temperatures of minus 70, 75, even higher. So that wouldn't impact the aeroplane as far as the coldness is concerned. What they also suggested that ice may have been involved and the engines, they may have flamed the engines out and ingested the ice. If that was the case, losing your engines, both of them, at that altitude is certainly a problem. However, you would normally have control of the plane. They are fabulous gliders and they'll glide for about 30 minutes as you descend. And you'd have plenty of time to do a mayday. So that was one interpretation. The other thing is, if you were encountering ice, you're in the middle of a thunderstorm and you're in the middle of a major downdraft. And ice is your least of your problems. The downdraft is your major problem because those downdrafts can be up to 100 miles an hour. And we have radio playback tapes from the Indonesians showing this plane descending at between 11,000 feet and 24,000 feet a minute.
As you know, the flight crew attempted to change its flight path, but was denied by air traffic control. Is that going to be reviewed, do you think?
Well, no. I mean, aircraft are constantly asking for permission to change altitude, and you're held down for a bit longer. I think it was about 2 or 3 minutes later that they were actually given permission to climb to 34,000 feet, not the 38 they wanted. The big question is, was it possible for him to be in what we suspect was a severe thunderstorm situation? Was his radar set correctly? Was it being interpreted correctly? Other aeroplanes were crossing through this weather system. There were 6 other aircraft in the area at the time. It would appear as though this was intensely localized, and I just think he just misread the intensity or misread the size because he's possibly his radar wasn't set correctly.
Thomas says compensation to the families of the victims of the December 28th crash may be affected by the airliner's apparent lack of permission from Indonesia to fly that Surabaya to Singapore route on Sundays. However, Singapore's Civil Aviation Authority said the carrier had been approved to fly the route daily. AirAsia has now been suspended from flying the route pending an investigation. Former Taiwan President Chen Shui-bian left prison Monday on a medical parole after several years because of declining health. Mr. Chen had served less than a third of his prison term. He was imprisoned on charges related to graft during his time in office, when he also angered Taiwan's political rival China by seeking the island's independence. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA in Taipei.
Taiwan's ex-president Chen Shui-bian left prison Monday for his family's home in South Taiwan. He was 6 years into a 20-year sentence for bribery, money laundering, and other corruption-related charges. His lawyer, Shi Yilin, said he had developed severe depression and incontinence, among other ailments. He says the ex-president's condition had developed to where he lacked dignity. When he wants to talk to us, Shu says, it takes someone else to push his wheelchair, and he walks with a cane. The lawyer adds that 15 medical experts have unanimously said Mr. Chen could be given treatment outside prison and that this outcome should be in accordance with the law. When in office from 2000 to 2008, Mr. Chen made a name for distancing self-ruled Taiwan from China, which claims the island as its own. Beijing fumed because Mr. Chen would not agree that China and Taiwan belong to the same country, and he advocated for drafting a new constitution that was widely believed would advance Taiwan's independence. The standoff made most dialogue impossible and prompted military threats from China. Since 2008, President Ma Ying-jeou has eased ties with both superpowers, leading to 21 landmark agreements with China. In 2009, a court convicted Mr. Chen of graft-related charges involving $20 million, making him Taiwan's first ex-president to serve time for crimes in office. His wife and two other family members were also convicted. Mr. Chen disputes all charges, calling them part of a political plot. The Justice Ministry's Agency of Corrections said Monday Mr. Chen could live at home because his neurological condition had deteriorated to where it could not be treated in prison. The agency said it had factored justice and humanitarianism into its decision. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Hopefully you had a good year for 2014, but if you didn't, it probably was not as bad as Cambodia's students. Final exam results there were disastrous, with more than half of the 90,000 students failing. The reason? Authorities stamped out cheating, the first of a series of reforms designed to fix the impoverished country's broken education sector. For VOA, Robert Carmichael joins us from Phnom Penh.
The decision to stamp out cheating had a huge impact. 60% of the class of 2014 failed their final year of school, despite getting a second chance to retake their tests in October. The class of 2015 has taken note. Final year student Ratanar says his peers realize the no cheating in exams rule means they will need to apply themselves to pass and get into university.
The new policy means we are studying harder and not going out as much as we used to. It also means we won't have to spend money during exams.
The new policy is courtesy of this man. Appointed a year ago after a decade as a deputy finance minister, Education Minister Hang Chun Naron says reforming education is critical to Cambodia's development.
So the most important factor is that the skill mismatch in Cambodia, and it becomes an obstacle to economic development, to growth, to attracting foreign direct investment. So we have, investor coming in, they look for skilled labor force. We don't have enough. But at the supply side, have many graduates, they cannot find job. And this is a problem that many countries are facing, the skill mismatch.
The new policy aims for improved teacher training, better school governance, and promoting critical thinking and problem solving for Cambodia's 2.9 million school-aged children. Underpaid teachers will earn more, and schools will get increased funding from an education budget that will rise sharply to $440 million. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Glad you could spend a little time with us today. As Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global, this is also a podcast. Why not subscribe for free? It's at voanews.com.
This is VOA Global. This is not a podcast, at least for the next couple of minutes or so. Yeah, I guess maybe it is. I don't know. I'm not sure. But nevertheless, this is your segment. You responding to some of the stories we're telling you on this program. Indonesian officials said a naval patrol vessel may have found what could be the section of a crashed AirAsia passenger jet where the crucial black box voice and flight data recorders are located. The possible discovery occurred the same day Indonesia suspended several aviation officials following the revelation that the flight did not have the proper permits to fly the day it went down in a storm over the Java Sea. Well, Shaza from Canada writes, wouldn't this tragedy relate the facts of crowded airspace, lower altitude than other airplanes at the time of the crash with the fact that Sunday was not the route allowed or permission taken? So the plane is flying when it shouldn't be. My prayers for the ones gone and strength for the ones behind. Lou from Atlanta says this is so similar to the Air France crash. Pilots tried to climb out of a storm in an Airbus A330. The engine stalled, and the plane fell into the sea. Do you think there might be a problem there?
As you may have read, the Boston Marathon bombing trial is getting underway, a search for justice and closure to that event. A lot of people responding on our website to our story about that. Jackie Becker from New York writes, "The truth is someone suspected this kind of activity long before it happened. I was a teacher. Ask any teacher in any district. They know things because the students tell them. Bring it to your authorities and who knows what happens, but," she says, "people knew." Franco from New York writes, "Looks like they are guilty. Would like to hear him speak freely about it, but..." Armego Vespucci says, "I hope they find him not guilty." Well, you can weigh in with your verdict at voanews.com. You can also write to us at voaasia@voanews.com.
Coming up on VOA Global, you will hear a report from Francis Alonso. Many countries are trying to curb their population. One of them is one of the most populous nations in the world, Indonesia. And Francis will tell you all about that with Women Rising. Also on China Focus, we'll continue our report from Michael Lippin about the problems China is having with the rest of the world buying its products. All that coming up on VOA Global.
Welcome to this edition of Voice of America's Women Rising. I'm your host, Frances Alonso. The United Nations Population Fund in 2010 identified Indonesia as the world's fourth most populous country and says that much of the world's overall increase in population between now and 2050 is projected to take place in high-fertility countries such as Indonesia. Ambar Rahayu is the principal secretary of the National Population and Family Planning Agency in Indonesia. She tells me how family planning is being marketed to women and their families in the hopes of limiting population growth.
To achieve stable population growth and support the family to achieve the quality family, we promote the norm of small family and happy and prosperous family.
How difficult is it to get women to use contraception in Indonesia? Are they open to family planning?
Yes, we are very open to family planning. We try to educate all mothers, married women, to use modern contraceptive. Right now, we have around 49 million eligible couples who are ready to use the contraceptive according to their needs. And we promote family planning through training for midwives and also training for the doctor.
Leaders in Indonesia, are they supportive? Are they not supportive? What's your opinion?
Policymakers support us because right now they have regulation to improve family planning. And also they support us by giving more money to do the revitalization of family planning in Indonesia. We are getting some assistance from donor agency to improve our supply chain management and monitor the progress of family planning. And we also trying to improve the quality of family enumeration. Indonesia has a good commitment in family planning 2020. We have made some progress, particularly in 2014, to reduce unmet need by providing free contraceptives and also free services for family planning. We signed a memorandum of understanding with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and I hope all stakeholders in Indonesia will support us. I have a big job how to facilitate all stakeholders and also all partnership in Family Planning 2020 to prepare to be a host of the fourth International Conference on Family Planning in Jakarta.
Between now and the conference, what are your goals for regards to family planning?
We are continuing to achieve the goal of family planning, how to decrease from 2.6 to be 2.1, because our population always increase, and then we are trying to reduce the unmet need from 8.5 to be 5.0. And then we are trying to encourage all family to use the contraceptive by choosing the long-term method of contraceptive. And then we are trying to encourage young people to delay marriage for women until 21 years old, and for boys for 25 years old. And we promote healthy reproductive for youth.
That is Ambar Rahayu, the Principal Secretary of the National Population and Family Planning Agency in Indonesia. The fourth International Conference on Family Planning is being held in Jakarta in November. To learn more, visit familyplanning2020.org. I'm Frances Alonso. Thank you for joining me on Women Rising.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. In yesterday's program, we looked at the issue of Chinese brands and how they've struggled to gain recognition from American consumers. The inability of most Americans to name a single Chinese brand is not the only challenge facing China's retailers in the U.S. They also have to contend with the legacy of American bias against all products that are made in China. A 2012 survey of U.S. adults by marketing research group JWT Intelligence found that prevailing consumer attitudes towards Chinese-branded products were negative. The respondents to that survey most commonly described Chinese brands as mass-produced, cheap, and having poor safety standards. My colleague Michael Lippin recently spoke to Jessica Vaughn, a JWT intelligence writer, and asked her why Americans tend to have such poor awareness and impressions of Chinese brands.
I think it's because China has served as a manufacturing hub for international brands for much of the 20th century, but it's only been in recent years that they have started to focus on building multinational brands of their own. So unfortunately, during China's run as the world's manufacturing hub, they've earned a really bad reputation for shipping out cheap, unsafe, mass-produced, or even forged products. So now the reality is that there's a really tough environment for Chinese brands that are seeking to expand internationally.
Recent surveys have shown that many U.S. consumers tend to see Chinese products as cheap, mass-produced, and lacking in safety. Are those opinions mostly coming from older generations of consumers?
Yes, I believe so. You know, younger generations, they're exposed to so much more globally than the previous generations were exposed to. So you have, you know, in schools, there's a lot of international students coming into the States from China. So these millennials are not growing up only reading about China in their history book or in the news or in a textbook. They're actually interacting with these people on a daily basis. You also have a lot of millennials that perhaps can't find jobs so easily in the States, and they're going over to China to take advantage of their booming economy. So they're way more open than previous generations were to the idea of Chinese brands.
Now, those surveys that I mentioned have shown that young consumers, or as you say, millennials, aged between 18 and 34, are developing more positive impressions of Chinese products. Which companies are benefiting from that, and how are they doing it?
Tech companies are the ones that are paving the way for Chinese brands in the U.S. market. So Lenovo, you know, is the largest PC manufacturer in the world. There's also Huawei, ZTE, Xiaomi, Tencent, and they're all leading the way by creating new and novel products that can compete at above or at a world-class level. So in some cases, they're even challenging incumbent brands. They're offering things that people haven't seen before, and that's changing the perception that Chinese brands are just copycats. So, you know, they're doing this by investing really heavily in research and development. You know, last year, Lenovo spent over $600 million in research and development. And ZTE, which is a mobile phone company, they unveiled a prototype of a modular phone. And that would completely change the way that you go about buying your cell phone, because you can choose, you know, the camera that is best suited for you. Maybe if you're constantly taking pictures, or if you need a longer battery life, you can have that sort of module put into the phone. Then there's also, you know, internet company Tencent, which markets WeChat. And that's right now pretty big in Asia, but it's moving over into the West as well. They have 300 million users globally, and they're investing in multinational ad campaigns as well. And they had one featuring soccer star Lionel Messi, which of course makes sense with the World Cup. So by offering these cutting-edge quality products, they're proving to consumers in the U.S. and elsewhere that made in China doesn't have to represent something of poor quality. It can be something really groundbreaking and different.
That was Jessica Vaughn, a writer for JWT Intelligence. For more on this topic, check out Michael Lippin's report on voanews.com, which includes illustrations of recent surveys on U.S. attitudes towards Chinese products, as well as audio from the analyst he spoke to yesterday, Doreen Wang, head of U.S. marketing company Millward Brown's Global Brand Database. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
With Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman on VOA Global from the Voice of America. This is Asia Business News. Shanghai shares began the new year the same way they ended 2014, surging almost 4% Monday, up 116 points to 3,351. First trading day of the year was its highest since August of 2009 after tacking on more than 50% last year. Tokyo eased about a quarter of a percentage point, or 4206, to end at 17409. Seoul closed 0.55% lower, or 10.69 points, at 1916. And Sydney added 0.26%, or just over 14 points, almost 14.5, to 5430.
BMW has agreed to offer 5.1 billion yuan. That translates into about $820 million. In subsidies to its China dealers. That's a bid to solve a continuing dispute with dealers amid slowing car sales. The China Automobile Dealers Association says the subsidies will be paid to dealers in February. A spokesman for BMW confirmed the company struck a deal with its dealers on subsidies but declined to disclose financial details. Last week, some BMW dealers threatened not to take new vehicles from BMW unless the German automaker agreed to lower sales targets and pay them subsidies.
WeBank, China's first private online bank, gave out its first individual loan Sunday, witnessed by Chinese officials. According to the state-run Xinhua news agency, WeBank, co-founded by internet giant Tencent Holdings Limited, is among the five pilot private internet banks approved by China's regulators last year to serve individuals and micro and small-sized enterprises as part of the nation's efforts to open up its state-dominated banking industry and spur economic growth. There you have it, a look at Asian business news from the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On January 6, 1412, Frances Joan of Arc was born. Joan was a peasant girl with mystical tendencies who became a military leader. She is considered a national heroine in France. On this day in 1838, American inventor Samuel F.B. Morse, credited with devising the code of dots and dashes that bears his name, successfully demonstrated for the first time the electric telegraph, a device that would revolutionize long-distance communication. American poet and biographer Carl Sandburg was born on this day in 1878. In 1893, a charter of Congress allowed the Protestant Episcopal Cathedral Foundation in Washington to establish a cathedral. The privately funded Washington National Cathedral was built between 1907 and 1990. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
There's a casino operator named Melco Crown Entertainment. On Friday, it applied to delist from the Hong Kong Stock Exchange just 3 years after listing its shares in the Chinese financial hub. It says it had limited fundraising opportunities and onerous compliance obligations and costs.
Well, the gambling company operates casinos in Macau, and they just opened a new one in the Philippine capital of Manila. But you see, China is cracking down.
as far as people perhaps making too much money is concerned or something like that. And the Macau casinos are in big, big trouble. The world's largest gambling market is Macau, at least it used to be. And the corruption crackdown scared off high rollers. Shares of the six licensed casino operators there fell an average of 40% last year. Not good business.
No, not at all. Well, don't be scared off, because the latest world news is coming your way next with Steve Norman and International Edition.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, search continuing for that crashed Air Asia jet, plus the U.S. training Iraqi forces. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Better weather helping search teams from several nations look for more bodies and debris from the crash of Air Asia Flight 8501. It's in the Java Sea off of Indonesia. As of late Monday, 37 bodies have been retrieved, along with several sections of the aircraft, which went down in a storm on December 28th. But recovery teams are still struggling to reach what they believe to be the plane's tail section, where the aircraft's flat data recorders, sometimes called black boxes, are located. Forensic experts from Australia have been working with Indonesia to assist in identifying the bodies. There were 162 people on board when the plane crashed. American Navy divers from the USS Fort Worth on Monday prepared to scan the sea floor. Naval personnel could be seen loading sophisticated sonar imaging equipment known as a C-scan onto the combat ship ahead of the mission. C-scan uses sonar to give the team an image of the sea bottom. U.S. Navy diver Second Class Daniel Clark.
We can find things as small as a golf ball or, of course, something as big as an airplane using different kilohertz bands and our swaths.
And the equipment allows for scanning to a depth of 609 meters at a low resolution.
Should we find targets out there, we'll switch over to a very high resolution. We'll go very slowly. We'll get very clear images.
USS Fort Worth is the second U.S. vessel to join the search for the wreckage of the Air Asia crash. USS Sampson arrived in Indonesia on December 29th at the request of the Indonesian government. Also in the news, two U.S. citizens are facing charges for their alleged role in last week's coup attempt in the Gambia, both men charged with conspiracy to violate the U.S. Neutrality Act, as well as a firearms charge. According to the Justice Department, the men traveled to the Gambia in December with the purpose of overthrowing the government. Criminal complaint says ahead of their trip, co-conspirators purchased weapons, including M4 semi-automatic rifles, and shipped them to the Gambia for use in the coup attempt. Says the conspirators expected one of them to serve as the Gambia's interim leader had the plot to overthrow President Yahya Jammeh succeeded. U.S. troops have started to train Iraqi security forces at a base in the volatile Anbar province, despite regular harassment fire from Islamic State militants. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says about 320 U.S. service members are stationed at Anbar's al-Assad base. They provide advice and planning assistance to Iraqi security forces as mortar fire from Islamic State militants rains down regularly near the base. But Warren says the enemy fire attacks are merely a nuisance.
They have thus far been wholly ineffective. No U.S. personnel, no U.S. equipment has been impacted in any way.
Warren says U.S. training of Iraq's 7th Division started at al-Assad base on December 20th.
The mission is focused on mission support planning, information and intelligence fusion, close air support coordination operations, and overall development of security strategies.
Elsewhere in Iraq, about 170 U.S. military personnel are training four Iraqi security force battalions at Camp Taji, about 30 kilometers outside of Baghdad. Two other training sites are developing in Erbil and Besmaya, although the Pentagon says neither of these are expected to be up and running for several more weeks. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Saudi officials said a suicide bomber has killed two border guards and wounded a third in an attack near the Iraqi border. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. Investigation of the incident is underway. Saudi Arabia's more than 800-kilometer border with Iraq has been attacked in the past by mortar bombs fired from a distance, but more targeted strikes are rare. Early last month, Saudi Arabia arrested 135 people, accusing them of scheming to sabotage security in the kingdom, smuggling weapons into the country, and helping raise money for terrorist groups. French President François Hollande has been calling for sanctions on Russia to be lifted if there is progress in Ukraine. We get the story now from Lisa Bryant in Paris.
During a two-hour radio interview, President François Hollande said sanctions imposed by Europe and the United States had not only hit Russia hard, but were also hurting the European economy.
Il faut parler à Poutine, je l'ai fait. Mais en même temps, il faut parler clairement.
Mr. Hollande told France Inter Radio that Europe should express what it wants clearly to Russian President Vladimir Putin. His actions must stop, he said, but there must also be no new sanctions, and those in place should be lifted if there is progress on Ukraine. That progress might happen next week when Ukraine and Russian leaders are expected to hold talks in Kazakhstan. The sanctions were imposed last year over Moscow's annexation of Crimea and its support of separatist fighters in eastern Ukraine. But today, European countries are raising concerns about the effect of the standoff on their own economies. France, for example, has suspended the sale of two warships to Russia over the Ukraine standoff. Mr. Hollande spoke during a wide-ranging interview that touched on France's sluggish economy, the Middle East crisis, and climate change. He also tackled another key European issue, Greece.
Les Grecs, ils sont libres de décider souverainement.
Mr. Hollande said it's up to the Greeks to choose whether they want to remain in the Eurozone, but he said Athens must respect its European commitments. Whether Greece remains in the Euro currency union might be decided during elections later this month. The Eurosceptic far-left Syriza party is leading in Greek public opinion polls. A few years ago, financial turmoil in Greece sparked fears of the Eurozone's collapse. But today, the Eurozone is on sounder footing. Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, Europe's most powerful country, reportedly considers Greece's departure from the Euro Union inevitable and manageable. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In a year that marks the 70th anniversary of World War II's end, a question weighs in the minds of some policymakers in Asia and as far away as here in Washington. What will Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe say about the country's role in the war? At a year-opening news conference on Monday, he sought to reassure the world that he wouldn't veer from past official statements on Japan's wartime responsibility. Some analysts have speculated that Mr. Abe, known for his nationalist views, might downplay Japan's responsibility for the war. 70 years on, the scars of World War II still poison relations in Asia, particularly between Japan and nearby China and South Korea, both victims of Japan's wartime aggression. That's a look at some of the stories making news. There's always more at voanews.com. Hope everyone has a great Tuesday.
This is Business News on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson. Do you have a little bit of extra money in your pocket now? Well, you might if you were an investor on Wall Street. A bout of selling took place, triggered by a renewed plunge in crude oil prices and surging dollar. That left the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials in a downward trajectory. The S&P 500 closed off session lows but still suffered its worst one-day decline in 3 months and recorded its longest losing streak in a year, falling for the fourth straight session. The benchmark index lost over 37 points, 1.8%, closing at 2020. The Dow Jones Industrial Average also had its worst down day in 3 months, 28 of its 30 components closing with losses. The Blue Chip Index closing at 17,501. The NASDAQ Composite also shedding points, down 1.6% at 45.52.
And oil continued its fall, stretching its losing streak to a third session and hitting its lowest levels in more than 5 years on concerns over a surging U.S. dollar and nagging worries of growing oil supplies. Light sweet crude for delivery in February fell $2.65 or 5% to settle at $50.04 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Prices traded as low as $49.70 a barrel earlier in the session. That settlement was the lowest for a front-month crude contract since 2009. Prices have lost 7.5% over the last three sessions.
U.S. officials, of course, are monitoring the recent drop in oil prices. They believe the dip so far has been beneficial for the U.S. economy. According to White House spokesman Josh Earnest, the U.S. average gasoline prices have fallen below $2 per gallon in much of the country. That has boosted U.S. car sales and other areas in recent months. That's a look at business news on VOA Global.
Here on VOA Global, is it too late to get a 2015 calendar if it's already 2015?
No,
I mean,
not
what
at all.
Good, what good is it?
Oh, it's still good for at least 11 months of the year. Come on.
Well, I guess so.
Yeah.
Of course, the way the mail is, maybe
pardon me.
It might arrive by 2016.
Write to us, VOA Asia at voanews.com.
Yeah, and that's how you get it. And it's a nice calendar, and it's free, and we'll stick it in the mail for you for nothing as well. We need your address, by the way. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Every day in the United States, a dozen pedestrians are struck and killed by cars. Local officials across the country have tried many approaches to improve safety. The Washington suburb of Montgomery County, Maryland, has launched a series of street safety awareness campaigns. As Faiza Al-Masri tells us in this story, narrated by Faith Lapidus, one of the most recent campaigns is graphic, using the storytelling power of comic strips.
When Montgomery County officials hired Sharp & Company to design their new campaign, the communication consultant group began with a close look at the targeted population, an immigrant neighborhood where pedestrian fatalities were on the rise.
And what we discovered was that while there were plenty of English-speaking people in the area, there was also a high percentage of Spanish-speaking people.
Company CEO Mary Arts says her team started to do more research, interviewing people from the community to determine the best way to reach them.
What is it about the Hispanic culture? What interests them? What's unique to them? As well as English-speaking folks. And we looked at this, and one of the things we discovered is that the telenovela is hugely popular in the Hispanic culture. A telenovela is a kind of television show. We might call it a soap opera in the U.S. So we thought, why don't we translate the telenovela into a comic or a graphic novel format?
And that's what they did.
We begin our story with Maria and Marco. And Maria very much loves Marco. And Marco has just been hit by a car. She's, you know, bemoaning that he was hit by a car. And then Marco admits to her that he didn't use the crosswalk. And now Maria is like, oh, my goodness, you didn't use the crosswalk. That's so dangerous. And now, Maria, as people are using the crosswalk, if only he'd used the crosswalk.
The graphic story is bilingual.
Dios mio! My beloved Marco has been hit by a car. And then Maria, mi amor. So there's just a little bit of Spanish added to the English. So we call that the Spanglish version.
The comic strips began appearing on buses and bus shelters.
People can see it quickly, understand what the messages are, and are attracted to it because it's a colorful medium.
Jeff Dunkel is pedestrian safety coordinator for the County Department of Transportation. He says there are two main causes for pedestrian accidents.
Cars not yielding to pedestrians in the crosswalk, and then pedestrians crossing where they shouldn't or when they shouldn't against the light. And we found that people were sometimes careless because they didn't feel like, you know, that they were really that much at risk.
While his department can modify traffic signal timing and upgrade sidewalks, Dunkel says educating the public about safety on the roadway is just as important. Using comics to deliver that message, he says, is clever and effective.
There was concern that maybe a comic strip wasn't a serious enough treatment of a serious issue like pedestrian safety, but I will say that the attention that this campaign has gotten is a testimony to how this is a serious treatment of this story.
Hispanic activist Carlos Iglesias is pleased with the campaign's focus on the Hispanic community, and he'd like to see it expand with the comic images in many other places.
I would like to see, for example, maybe people with t-shirts, members of the community talking with other members in the community in the bus stop, for example.
Jeff Dunkel says he welcomes any suggestions that can help reduce pedestrian fatalities. The graphic approach for raising awareness has attracted attention outside the county.
The Library of Congress has called us and asked us to contribute the campaign to their permanent collection for the Applied and Graphic Arts Division, which we're completely excited about. It's really a great acknowledgement.
Mary Art says the message of this campaign is clear. Whether driving or walking, people look after one another because pedestrian safety is everyone's responsibility. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Please come on in every day at voanews.com and as a podcast, listen to us on many platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. The International Diabetes Federation says that worldwide 387 million people have diabetes. There are three main types. Type 1, an autoimmune disease where insulin-producing cells in the pancreas are destroyed. Type 2, where the pancreas doesn't produce enough insulin to turn sugar into energy. And type 3, where women develop diabetes during pregnancy. About 10% of the patients in the world have type 1 or juvenile diabetes. Patients have to monitor their blood sugar and take insulin several times a day. Testing usually involves a painful finger stick blood test. But some scientists in Britain have come up with a different way to test: breathing. The British researchers have linked a sweet-smelling chemical called acetone in the breath to the buildup of chemicals in the blood that are present when insulin is low. Gus Hancock is an Oxford University emeritus professor of chemistry. He told Reuters that the sweet breath syndrome has been linked with diabetes since ancient times.
It's been known for thousands of years. People have noticed the sweet smell of the breath of people suffering from diabetes. And this sweet smell is this particular ketone which is given out. It's called acetone. And doctors have regularly smelled acetone on the breath of patients who are in the state of diabetic ketoacidosis and used it as a diagnostic.
In the study, the researchers collected breath samples from 113 children and teens and found a significant relationship between the increased levels of acetone in the breath and increased blood ketones, indicators of possible diabetes. Dr. Ian Campbell is the CEO of Oxford Medical Diagnostics. He told Reuters that researchers developed a device that can measure minute particles of acetone in someone's breath.
In order to make breath measurements, you have to account for the fact that breath has millions of compounds in it. We want to identify and measure one of them. So what we do is we allow a subject to blow into the device. We extract out the volatile organic compounds we wish to measure, in this case acetone. The remainder of the breath passes through the device. We then release the molecule that we're interested in into the cavity to make the measurement. Purely we use it to concentrate the molecules that we are interested in measuring.
Right now the device is about the size of a shoebox, but Gus Hancock says that researchers are working on making a smaller, convenient-sized device.
The aim that we have is to get this into a handheld device here that somebody can pick up and use by blowing simply through a mouthpiece.
Hancock says the smaller device would give doctors advance notice that a child might be diabetic without the trauma of doing blood tests.
Well, it will never replace the standard blood test, but what it might be able to do is to act for these children as a screen to see whether or not they've got diabetes or there's a hint of diabetes, and therefore if they need further tests.
And this technology has a side benefit. Gus Hancock says the technology could also be used to help people who are trying to lose weight.
Recently, we've been using this to observe what happens to people who are on a diet. Because people who are dieting, their body If they're dieting correctly, their body burns fat. That's what you want to do when you're on a diet. You don't want to burn carbohydrate that you've eaten, you want to burn fat. And burning fat in your body produces acetone. So an elevated level of acetone can be used as a test to see if your diet is working.
But there's no cheating with this device. If the acetone isn't there, you're not burning fat, so your diet is not working. So what do you think? Would you use this new test? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can always email us your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
This is VOA Global with Jim Stevens, and I'm Ira Melman. We're going to tell you about what happened to a bobcat, you know, a big cat, you know, one of those things in Arizona. A bobcat may have used up one of its 9 lives. It survived getting stuck inside of a car. It's a big thing. Arizona Game and Fish Department, a spokesperson, said the bobcat appears to have escaped any serious injuries, awaiting evaluation. As it was hit by a couple in Scottsdale, got stuck in the grill and made it. They called it a miracle.
This is sports on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson. Sad news from the ski slopes where 2 U.S. ski team prospects died Monday in an avalanche. Ronnie Burlak, age 20, and Bryce Assel, 19, died while training in Solden, Austria, ahead of the start of the first leg of the Skiing World Cup, that according to U.S. officials. The development-level skiers were among 6 caught in the avalanche, according to a statement on the ski team's website. The other 4 were able to ski out of the slide.
Now, coming off of that story, something much lighter happened in Perth, Australia. See, Serena Williams, playing in a tournament there, she said she was feeling lethargic and jet-lagged, so she decided a cup of coffee might perk her up after losing her first set, 6-0, 6-0 at the Hopman Cup. It did the trick. Williams recovered to beat Flavia Panetta, 0-6, 6-3, 6-0 on a sweltering day in Perth. John Isner followed up with a 5-7, 7-5, 7-6 win over Fabio Fognini, and the American pair combined to win the doubles for a 3-0 win over Italy in Group A on Monday in the international mixed team competition. Williams later joked it was miracle coffee. She laughed out loud as she checked with the chair umpire and then with a tournament referee about the coffee before a ball girl served her the brew on court.
It was a double espresso, I believe, and that's good because she won doubles and 2 sets to win her singles match.
And she got cream with it, too.
How about that? Yeah. Top-seeded Simona Halep didn't seem to need any coffee. She overcame 10 double faults and a tough challenge from Germany's Annika Beck to advance to the second round of the Shenzhen Open with a 4-6, 6-4, 6-3 victory. Wimbledon champion Petra Kvitova, seeded 2nd, had a 6-3, 6-1 win over Duan Yingying of China.
In the U.S., the National Football League playoffs continued Sunday. Quarterback Andrew Luck led the Indianapolis Colts to a 26-10 over the Cincinnati Bengals in the AFC wildcard game that sets up a divisional round clash with Peyton Manning and the Denver Broncos next week. And in the NFC wildcard game, quarterback Tony Romo engineered a stirring second-half comeback to lead the Dallas Cowboys to a nail-biting 24-20 win over the Detroit Lions and a trip back to the divisional round to meet the Green Bay Packers. There you have it, a look at sports from Voice of America.
We'll leave it to Taylor Swift to spoil Disney's Frozen party. It came down to the wire, but in the final week of 2014, Swift's 1989 finishes as the year's top-selling album. After only 9 weeks on sale, it stole away the title from Walt Disney Records' Frozen soundtrack in the very last tracking frame of the year. Let's listen to a track from her album 1989, Out of the Woods. Those in our audience more mature, I won't call you older. It wasn't skipping. It was meant to sound like that.
But it would never end.
I know.
It never came to an end.
Well, it just did.
She's still singing.
Taylor Swift, Out of the Woods. You know, her 1989 album is selling like no other in the past 10 years. It sold more than 200,000 copies in each of its first 9 weeks on sale. That's a feat not managed since the spring of 2004. Can you guess who it was? Usher. Confessions was the last album to sell as consistent as Taylor Swift's.
Has anyone over the age of 14 ever bought a Taylor Swift song?
No.
No, I don't think so. That's
on VOA Global.
Both of us told you that. We have a very, very effective, good institution in the Washington, D.C. area here.
Yes.
It's called the National Institutes of Health.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Large. They do great work. But if you walk in there, you're going to see a bar, and it's going to smell of alcohol.
Right.
But guess what? There's no alcohol on there. It's all part of research. They're testing a drug that could curb a drinker's desire to over-imbibe. ABC News reports the drug is intended to block a hormone that makes us desire food and alcohol. Researchers found that when they increased the hormone ghrelin in volunteers, the volunteers had a greater urge to drink. Scientists want to see if blocking production of the ghrelin will make people not want to drink, and they came up with an interesting way to test that theory. So they created a fake bar inside the hospital at the NIH. They purposely created a real bar atmosphere to increase the volunteers' urge to drink, but there's no real beer in the taps or alcohol in the bottles behind the bar. However, the smell of real alcohol is used to tempt volunteers into wanting a drink. If the volunteer gives into temptation, researchers can see if the new pill counters the urge to drink.
So I guess you can call that the placebo bar.
The placebo.
Yeah, I wonder if they have that a neon light above it, the placebo.
Probably so, you know, and it probably says bar or eat at Joe's or something like that.
Yeah, you know, we ought to start a non-alcoholic bar and call it the placebo.
As long as you put alcohol in. Our thanks today to Tracy Carter, our director. Keith Holmes has been pushing the buttons and sliding all the faders and everything like that. And Diane Gall doing what she does, and that is serve as boss to all of us. Thanks to all of them, and thanks to all of you for being with us.
Have a great day. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll do it again tomorrow. Join us.